Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Much better if I'm up here than going, and then, oh gosh, thank you, Alan, and thank you so much for asking me to come and do this. Okay, is that better? Good, okay. I'm nervous. I'm going to just tell y'all up front. I'm going to take a little drink of this, hold on. I get really bad cotton mouth when I'm nervous, so if y'all see the glass going like this. Anyway, so thank you so much for asking me to come do this. What an honor and a privilege to be coming and sharing here. I've come to this conference before. I never in a million years dreamed that I would be up here talking. You know, I am not the biggest fan of public speaking, but In fact, I had no idea that being sober was going to require all this public speaking. But honestly, I am what a small price to pay for such a beautiful life I've been given. You know, I have been saved from a hopeless state of mind and body, and if that means public speaking every single day, then I am happy to do it. So thank you. The other thing I just want to say is, Lyle, I will be 42 in September, so you don't have to do math. I mean, if you're like me, you try to spend most of your time trying to avoid doing as much math as you can. And I was given the gift of sobriety on April 6th of 1996, and I'm forever grateful. That's 18 years. And I guess I'll start at the beginning. I am the fifth generation of alcoholics, and I'm the first one to get sober. My name growing up was Krista, go give me a beer. And being the good little budding alcoholic waitress that I was, I would bring their beers to them opened, and I would take a little sip. And pretty soon they started getting their beers half empty. And they would say, go get your own. I was raised in alcoholism, as you can imagine. And you know, there was never really a time in my life that it wasn't okay for me to just go get a beer and drink it. But I knew that that wasn't something that I was supposed to do whenever people were over at the house, when your grandparents were there. It was one of those unspoken secrets that we had, you know, growing up in alcoholism. So my parents, my mom and my dad, they actually were, you know, they grew up in Pampa, Texas, and they dated almost their whole lives. And they, all through junior high, high school, college, they got married. They were married for 13 months, just barely long enough to have me, and got divorced. My mom, they both got remarried pretty quickly. My mom married my stepdad, and that was the alcoholics, and my dad married my stepmom, and they were like Ward and June Cleaver. So I had these two really opposite lives going on. You know, I was raised in alcoholism, and then every other weekend I would go and I would visit Ward and June Cleaver. And I can remember the feeling that I felt growing up pretty much all the time was that I felt invisible. I felt like whenever I went to my dad and my stepmom's house, they wanted something from me that I really didn't have to give. You know, they wanted to talk to me, and they wanted me to go to church and sit down at the dinner table. And then, you know, at my mom and my stepdad's, it was pretty much a free-for-all. And I just felt, you know, I felt like most of us did. I felt irritable, restless, and discontented. And I was, you know, starting to act out and just trying to do anything to escape that feeling. I had not found almighty alcohol quite yet. But I would sneak out and steal the car when I was 10 years old. And I did some wild and crazy things, just trying to get out of my body, get out of my skin as fast as I could. And anyway, so whenever I was, one thing did happen. I can remember standing in front of the refrigerator when I was about 7 or 8, and I was slamming beers with the little girl that lived across the street, Shelly Bailey. And I said to Shelly, you know, if you drink these beers fast enough, you can feel it. You can feel it tingle down the backs of your arms and your legs. And she could never feel that. And I just thought she wasn't doing it right. But what I know about that now is that that was literally my body absorbing the alcohol. I was having a different reaction to alcohol that Shelly never had and never would have. You know, I whenever I was in the fourth grade, something happened. I went to school one day, and fourth grade is the year that you take music and art for the first time. And my art teacher turned in one of my class projects into a national art contest and did not tell me. I came to school, and the principal called my name over the announcements and told me to come to the principal's office, and I thought I was getting swats. So I was hysterical by the time I got there. And my parent, you know, the newspapers and TV reporters and everybody was there, and I had won this big art scholarship and some money, and they put my picture on bulletin boards all over the country, and I won an art scholarship, and my parents were like, "We produced an artist. We are so fantastic. Look what we did. We are amazing." And so they're like, "You are going to be a famous artist." And they enrolled me into college course art classes right away. And I already felt like an alien. And so I'm 11 years old, and I'm taking these college course art classes with 28-year-old people. And I felt like an alien. I felt invisible. And so I rejected that, and I didn't really paint anything else or do anything to, you know, draw more attention to myself. And so, you know, I pretty much skirted through high school, and I didn't get into a whole lot of trouble. I graduated early when I was 16 years old, and I left home and never looked back. But what happened for me is whenever I got out of my parents' house, I no longer had them to mirror off of. Because the only thing I really wanted to be was not my mother. I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. And whenever I didn't have her there to compare my drinking to, I could finally start drinking the way that I wanted to. And so I did, and I got a job I was a teller. And I was working in the drive-ups, and this girl came through the drive-ups, and she kind of looked like me, and she was 22 years old, and I called down to her, and I said, "Ma'am, you didn't close your tube good, and your withdrawal slip and your driver's license got sucked out in the tube. And gosh, I hope you don't have to pay for the repairs on this." And I stole her driver's license and used that as a fake ID for many years. One other thing that I did while I was working there was, you know, I wasn't really making enough money to support this old drinking habit I had started. And so I would borrow from my teller drawer just a little bit. And that was getting kind of dangerous. And so I developed another little scheme, which was I would write a check to myself and I would deposit it into my own account, which would double my money for a couple of days before payday. And it turns out that is called check hiding, and it's a federal offense. So I worked for a federal credit union, and the feds came one day, and they audited the credit union and found out that, you know, I was doing this. And they walked me out to my car, and they said, "You know, this is a really serious deal, but, you know, you are just a young baby, and we are going to, you know, slap you on the hand and, you know, turn you loose." And I can specifically remember thinking, I have to find some place that I can do this again. And I just went right around the corner and got a job at a bank to do the exact same thing. The consequences just were not great enough for me. I was like, I can't not do this. So I went to the bank and I started doing that again. And my new supervisor there, he was training me and on the first day. And he started talking a lot about drinking. And what I liked about him most was that he was not embarrassed of his drinking. He was like, "I'm an alcoholic, and this is how I drink, and this is what I do," and I really liked that. And so I moved in with him. I moved in with him on Friday, and again, you know, he knew the rules of drinking. He knew that you never ran out. You never went anywhere that they weren't drinking, and drunk stuff doesn't count. And I was like, this is clearly my guy. and we had a lot of fun, and you know how alcoholics are. We always, you know, water meets its own level, and we always surround ourselves with people that drink like we do. And our friends, we all, you know, called ourselves the BWC, which is the Bedwetters Club. And I see there are some fellow members. And after a time, you know, our drinking began to change just a little bit. And the BWC stopped coming over, and they started saying things like, you know, you guys are a little bit too much. I should back up a little. So one day we were at his grandparents' house for Mother's Day. There was a big, we were having a camp out or whatever, cookout. And he stood up and he said, I have an announcement to make. I'm getting married. And I said, you are? To who? And he said, well, to you. And I was like, okay, all right. But I mean, that's how I made major decisions in my life at that time. And so, you know, we got married and like I said, you know, we surrounded ourselves with people that drank like us. And then, you know, things, like I said, my drinking started to change a little bit. You know, I started to experience some of the dark side of alcoholism. And I remember one time I misjudged how much I had at home. And we had gone out to the bar, and I came home and thinking that there was plenty at home to finish drinking. And there wasn't. But I noticed that there was people on my street whose lights were on. This is 3:30, 4 in the morning. And I thought, for sure, they're up drinking. They're not. They were not. You know what they're doing? They're getting ready to go to work because they're on the night shift. They're up with their sick baby. And the reason I know that is because I went and rang their doorbell begging for booze. And I remember feeling that incomprehensible demoralization. I remember feeling desperate to drink. And so, like I said, it got bad. And one night I remember... We reenacted a child from a scene from my childhood, and we were fighting. You know, it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I got mad. But something had happened to me that night, and that had never happened before. It was a 3-day weekend at the bank, a holiday, and I'd been drinking pretty much around the clock for 3 days. And for the first time in my life, I could not get drunk, no matter how much I drank. Alcohol had stopped working for me, and I was terrified. The only solution that I had ever had to that deep sense of loneliness stopped working for me. And like I said, he and I got into this huge fight, and I took my wedding ring off, threw it at him, I'm leaving, and I took my stuff, and, well, I took the ficus tree, the ottoman, and my shoes, because that's what you need when you're leaving. So I went to my parents' house, who happened to be up at 4 a.m. in the morning drinking. And we went in there, and we decided, you know, that it was clearly his fault. He was the problem. And I got that all cleared up. And it was about 10 in the morning. And I always say what time it was, because I was really shocked to find out that I had my last drink at 10 in the morning. I don't know if you guys know this, but only alcoholics drink in the morning. That was one of the rules I was really trying to abide by. But I drank in the morning all the time. I just called it different things. I called it vacation. I called it mimosas. I called it, you know, a lot of things. But anyway, so I had my last drink at 10 in the morning. And I went in there to take out my contacts to go to bed. And I looked in the mirror, and I did not recognize myself. I saw these red, saggy, bloodshot eyes looking back at me. And it was my mother. And I said, oh, holy hell, I have finally become everything I was never going to be. And I put my contacts back in, and I said that prayer that we all say. I said, God, help me. And I don't think I'd ever said that before. And I called my husband at the time, and I said, you know, I'm coming home. We got to talk. So I got home, and I said, you know, we have a terrible drinking problem, and we got to go to AA. And he said, you're right, you do. It's bad. It's bad. Just go there quickly. I should also back up a little bit and say that, you know, I was working at the bank, and like I said, water meets its own level, and my boss was also an alcoholic, and he and I would, as soon as I'd worked my way up into investments, and as soon as the market would close, he and I would go to the bar and drink together. And I remember one day his wife called, and I was going to tell on him. We had this tumultuous relationship like brother and sister. I would quit about once a month and, you know, storm out and go home, and he would drive to my house and beg me to come back to work. And so I'd go back to work, and then I'd quit again, and then I'd come back, and we just did that on and on. And one day his wife called, and I was going to tell on him. And she stopped me, and she said, you know, Krista, before you go any further, I just want to tell you that I know a place that might help you. It's called Al-Anon. And I said, She said, I don't need to go to Al-Anon. I went to Alateen whenever I was young, and, you know, it didn't really help me much. In fact, me and those Alateen kids, we used to go out after the meetings and go to the gay bar and go drinking. And I said, but there was this... there was this counselor that did help me, and gosh, I think if I could ever find her, that would be good. And she said, well, what's her name? And I said, Sunny Hill. And she said, well, Sunny's okay if I say this from the podium. She and I talked about it. She said, well, I happen to know her. Here's her phone number. Why don't you give her a call? So I did, and I said, you know, Sunny, this is Krista. You're never going to remember me. She's like, oh, I remember you. I remember you. So I called her, and I said, you know, I'd like to come see you again. And she said, well, I had about 16 years of sobriety, and I've been drinking for about 6 months. I'm not going to be able to help you. And I remember thinking that that wasn't good, but I didn't really understand the gravity of what she had just said. What an honest thing to share with me. And so anyway, she said, but I do know this other counselor who's really good, and you should call her and make an appointment. So I did, and this counselor couldn't see me for 2 weeks. Well, my appointment happened to be that next Monday morning. And so I, you know, went to work all day, and I went in to go see her about 5 o'clock in the evening. And I went in, I sat down, and I said, you know, my parents are bad alcoholics, and they've just about ruined me. And I could have a tiny, tiny beginning of an alcohol problem myself. And she said, well, I can't see you till you've been to at least one meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's one starting in 15 minutes. Here's the address. Come back tomorrow. And she threw me out the door. And so I was on my way to my first AA meeting. And I went there, and I walked in, and there were about six grandpas sitting there. And I sat down, and they said, are you new? And I said, yes, I am. How did you know? And so they started the meeting, and they started talking about the way that they felt before they drank, the way they felt while they drank, and the way they felt after they drank. And I knew in that minute that those men knew all of my secrets. They knew the stuff I was never going to tell anyone. All of that age difference and gender difference, everything just totally melted. And I was like, these are my people. The mothership has landed. And after that meeting, they went on to say, you know, that that I was the lifeblood of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that they needed me there. They needed newcomers. And so I went back the next day because they needed me. I did. I thought, how can those guys stay sober without me? I have to go tomorrow. The lifeblood of AA. And so I did, and I went every day, and I didn't drink. And then Friday came. And I went in, and I brought in a little tablet and a pen with me this time. And I said, you know, I have been coming all week, and today is Friday. And I have never not drank on Friday, and you have not told me how to not drink. And so I'm ready. I'm ready to write it down. Tell me step by step. And they said, well, you're going to have to ask God to relieve you of the obsession to drink alcohol. And I went, oh, gosh, that's never going to work. What else you got? And they said, well, that's all we got. And they were like, what else, you know, what do you have to lose? I was like, you know what, I really don't have anything at all to lose. And I went into the bathroom, and I got down on my knees, which was embarrassing and felt a little bit unnecessary, but I did anyway. And I asked God to relieve me of the obsession to drink alcohol. And I went home and I went to bed and I woke up the next morning. And the first time, and I don't know how long, I did not have the constant obsession about when am I going to drink? Where am I going to drink? How am I going to drink? How am I going to get the money to drink? What did I say when I drink? The big book calls it the hideous four horsemen. And for the first time in my life, I woke up without them and I had had a miracle. I was like, I cannot believe that that worked. And so I went back and I, you know, pretty much threw myself into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, they said you need to work the steps and it needs to be, you need to get a sponsor. It needs to be with a woman. And so I went for like 2 weeks and no women came. And then finally this poor woman came in. And I, oh man, I was on her. I was all over her. And she was like, you need to step back and take a breath. And, you know, she and I, we worked the steps and she started talking to me about habits consistent with sobriety. And, you know, my brain was so pickled. I couldn't understand anything that I read. I mean, I just was a mess. And so she would write down on these little note cards instructions about, you know, get up in the morning and get down on your knees and ask God to keep you sober and, you know, read these pages and come to a meeting. I mean, she wrote it all down and so that I could remember what to do. And, you know, years later, she said, you remember those cards I gave you? And she said, I said, yeah. And she said, well, they're written on the back of note cards, these little black and white note cards of all of these women, like Greta Garbo and some political, you know, leaders that were women. And she said, you know why I chose those cards? And I said, no. And she said, well, because all of those women have grace and dignity, and that's what you're going to get back if you stay sober. And that has been true for me. You know, I was really, you know, confused whenever I came in. They were all talking about the steps and speaking in these words. And, you know, people were talking in numbers. They were like, you're going to feel a lot better when you do 4 and 5. And I think that this is a 6 and 7 issue. Hey, Bob, how you doing? I'm good. I'm hanging out in 10, 11, and 12. And I didn't understand that. And I was like, where are the steps? Are they out back? Do I need special tennis shoes? How is this going to happen? And, you know, and they were like, you know, you got to have faith, get busy. I mean, all these riddles, I just did not get it. And so this woman, you know, sat down and clarified all that with me. And I'll remember my first four-step. I, you know, wrote down this huge inventory, and it was mainly about, you know, growing up in alcoholism, about what my parents, you know, had done. And I thought she was going to be like my Aunt Jeanette. I thought she was going to go, oh, baby, God, love it. Those jerks, let's go get them. And that is not what she did. She wanted to talk about my part. And she started, you know, we read in the fifth step where it says that we hid behind hurt pride and anger. And we accused others of the very character defects that we had. And we accidentally caused the loneliness that we were trying to avoid. And whenever I saw that I was the one that was causing all of this, that just totally changed everything. Another thing that really changed everything for me was one of the grandpas. He sat me down and he said, you know, you've been coming to these meetings and you've been talking a lot about your parents' alcoholism. And I said, yeah. They, you know, I do. And he took me to We Agnostics, and we read that first paragraph. And we read about what a real alcoholic is. Whenever you truly want to, you cannot stop. And once you start, you know, all of those things. And I normally can quote that, but I'm a little nervous. So, and he said, so your parents, they held you down and they poured whiskey down your throat. And I said, no, you know, they've done a lot of things, but they never did that. He said, I see, so you poured whiskey down your own throat. And I said, yeah, exactly. And I began to recover that day from my alcoholism. And then, you know, that fourth step, that fourth and fifth step that I did really, really changed things for me. I started to recover, and I started to feel better. And the more sober I got, the drunker Danny got, my husband. And I just say that, you know, I got sober with a 12-pack of beer in my refrigerator, and if I can do that, anybody can. And I was, after on my one-year birthday, some of the people from my AA group, they said, you know, we are sick and tired of hearing you talk about your drunk husband and your drunk boss and your drunk friends and your drunk parents. You got to go to Al-Anon. You're driving us crazy. So I did. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, 1 year and 1 day of sobriety. And I'm a really active and a grateful member of Al-Anon consistently all these years, and I'm so grateful for that. So anyway, I learned how to be okay no matter what he did. And about 2 years sober, I came home one day. It was just a mundane Tuesday afternoon. Nothing was different about that day. Nothing had changed, really. And I sat him down and I said, you know, I love you, but I love me way, way too much to live like this. I'm leaving. And I left, and a good friend of mine, she said, you know, we don't have anything really holding us here at Amarillo. Let's move to Dallas. And so I did. I was a few months away from taking my Series 7, and I thought, you know, I'm going to go to Dallas and just see about this creative thing. And for the first time in my life, I wasn't running from anything, and I wasn't running to anything. And I came to Dallas, and we were going to stay on her boyfriend's couch until we found a place to live and jobs and all of that. And whenever we pulled up in the U-Haul, it was actually Super Bowl Sunday, and the guys that were there to unload our U-Haul, I must have said some sort of AA jargon, because one of the guys said, are you a friend of Bill's? And I said, yes. And he said, well, let's go to a meeting and let these guys unload the truck. So he took me to the Preston Group, and there was about 150 people in that meeting, and I thought that that was the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous for the Metroplex of Dallas and Fort Worth. It was a giant meeting. And I went there every day, and I was really nervous, and I would kind of slip in the back and pass whenever it was my turn to share, and I started getting real anonymous in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day, this girl that I was sitting by, she had, you know, eyes this big, and I said, yeah, this is intense, huh? And she said, yeah, will you be my sponsor? And I said, yeah, but I better get one first. And so, you know, that girl, she actually, she died. She relapsed right before her four-step, and she drove her car into a tree and died. And she taught me that I didn't have the power to get anybody sober, and I don't have the power to get anybody drunk. And I'm really grateful for that. So anyway, like I said, I just threw myself into the middle of AA, and I, you know, got a little job at an accounting, advertising firm. I was just a little receptionist, and I wasn't really making enough money to, you know, live in Dallas. And I was going through the want ads, you know, really late at night, on a weeknight, and there was an ad in the newspaper, and it said an entry-level graphic artist position. I said, well, I don't have any experience doing that, but I'm just going to apply and see what happens. And I expected to get a fax machine to fax in my resume, and the woman answered the phone, and she said there was a misprint in the newspaper. I own an art gallery. I'm an art consultant, and I need an assistant. I said, I don't have any experience in that, but I'd like to apply. And she said, well, let's just do an interview right now. So we did, and she hired me, and I went to work there the next day. And she said, you know, I really need somebody to do some paintings for me, just a local artist, something inexpensive. And I said, well, you know, I used to paint a little bit a long, long time ago. I don't even know if I can anymore. But she goes, well, why don't you paint something? Let me see it. So I did that night, and I brought it in. And as I was waiting for her to come to work, another woman came in to get something framed, and she saw it, and she said, well, who did this? And I said, well, I did. She said, well, I'd like to have an art show for you. And she said, can you have 36 paintings by next month? And I said, yeah. So I did, and I sold them all that night. And a guy came, and he saw, a man came to that show, and he said, you know, I am doing a pilot series for NBC, and we'd like to use your art on our first TV show. And so I said, okay. And, you know, so fast forward to today, and I have this amazing art career. I mean, I've had my art in 8 movies, and I have, you know, national and international publishers. You can buy my art in Crate and Barrel and Pier 1 and all over the place. And I tell you that not to brag, but just so that you can understand the gravity of what I'm about to say next, which is I have never taken an art class in my life. I have never written an email. I've never made a phone call. I do not have an art portfolio. I do not know the difference between Monet and Manet. I know very little about art. And I have this amazing art career. And it's a miracle. And people on the outside can't understand that, except you and Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I haven't done anything, but what I have done is I have worked my butt off at becoming emotionally available enough to receive this life. I learned how to answer the phone. I learned how to say yes. I learned how to paint the paintings, to just pick up the brush and start, to just unclog that channel of fear that clogs me from my source so that I can become the woman that I'm supposed to be. And I learned all of that from you here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was about 5 years sober, and I decided to stop smoking. And what happened was that the lid came off, and I stopped being able to control the words that would come out of my mouth. And I was a crazy person, and newcomers and meeting would come up to me afterwards and ask me if I needed the sponsor. And they'd give me their phone numbers, and I would call them. I'd be like, this is Sally, and the weird. Anyway, so they would, you know, give me the stuff that works, the stuff that you learned in your first 30 days, and it was awesome. But anyway, so during that time, you know, my mom called and she said, I got really sick and I had to go to the hospital. And they did a bunch of tests on me, and turns out I've had stroke. And they found out that I have really terrible heart disease. The doctor said it's because of my drinking and smoking. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And she goes, well, I guess I'll hope for the best. And so because the lid was off, I proceeded to tell her exactly what I thought about that. And she goes, you are hysterical. You need to call your AA people or whatever it is that you do. And I was like, how dare you be more recovered than me right now? So I did. And, that next weekend, it was singles and sobriety. And I went to that conference with one of my girlfriends. And on Saturday, she wanted to go to the women's meeting. And I wanted to go on the boat with the cute boys. But she was really insistent on going to the women's meeting, so I did. And there was this woman there, and she was well into double-digit sobriety, and she started talking about these resentments that she had about her mother that she had through her whole sobriety, and she just could not get over it. And she realized it was because she couldn't see her part. And what she did was she stopped forcing herself to pretend that she was somebody that she wasn't. And so she stopped making herself go to Christmas and stopped making herself do all these things that her heart was not authentically doing. And what she did instead was she sat home and she tried to think of one thing that her mom did right. And it took her a long, long time to come up with one thing. And when she did, she sent it to her mom in an email. And her mom didn't respond or anything. And a couple weeks later, she remembered something else, and she wrote it and she sent it to her mom. And pretty soon it started flowing, and she started thinking about a lot of things her mom did right. And one day her brother called, and he said, you know, could you please stop sending these emails to mom? She forwards them to everyone in the family, and frankly, we're sick of hearing about it. And so I really was forced to face this topic of forgiveness with my mom. And I knew that I had two choices. I was either going to forgive her, or I was going to make amends, and I sure wasn't ready to make amends. So I, I started reading a bunch of, you know, non-conference approved literature. I started reading Sermon on the Mount, and I started trying to think of one thing that my mom did right. And the thing that the first thing I remembered was that whenever I was in high school, a good friend of mine, was murdered by another kid in our class. He shot him in the face with a shotgun. And my mom was, like, really worried about me. And she was like, do you want me to go to the funeral with you? And I was like, of course not. Yeah, I will be fine. I'm fine. And so I went to the funeral. And after the funeral, I was walking out, and I fainted. And whenever I woke up, my mother was standing there looking at me. She had been following me all day long, just keeping her distance. And I just wondered how much of my life my mom did that, you know. She really had been there. She had a terrible, terrible disease of alcoholism, when it really mattered, you know, my mother, I knew my mother loved me, and she would lay down in traffic for me. So anyway, I was doing all this work, and my mom called, and she said, you know, more tests have come back, and they found out that I have breast cancer also. And so I've been doing chemo, and they're going to do a mastectomy on me, and I'd like for you to come and be here for the operation. And so my first thought was, I don't want to go. I don't want to be the mama. I'm tired of taking care of you. I've been taking care of you my whole life, and I don't want to be here while you suffer the consequences of your disease. I don't want to go. But that is not the woman that I want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, and what came out of my mouth was, absolutely, I'll be there. So I went, and I didn't recognize my mom. She was, you know, about 90 pounds. She's gray. She's bald. She looked like a skeleton with skin draped over her. It was like breathtaking, her appearance. And so she had the operation, and whenever she came out of her anesthesia, I was the only one in the room with her, and she opened up her eyes, and she looked at me, and she said, take me home. And I knew that my mom needed a drink. And something came over me that day, and I was like, you know what, Krista, this woman has suffered enough. You no longer need to withhold your love from this woman. She's suffered enough. And I realized that that's what I was doing. I was trying to punish her for the very disease that I have. And, you know, I let my mom off the cross that day, and I picked her up, and I took her home, and I gave her a drink. And I wish that I could say that it's just been fantastic with my mom. She and I just skipped off into the sunset together, and it's just been glorious, and it hasn't. It has been a process. But I can tell you that I can hug my mom today without peeling my skin off. And I'm grateful for that, because it wasn't like that for a long, long time. Right after that, I get a call, and it's my ex-husband. Oh, I forgot to tell y'all something. So 90 days after we got divorced, he got remarried. And he got sober. He stopped drinking, and they adopted a kid together, and they opened a church, and he just had this wonderful life. And I thought, well, gosh, God just needed to get me out of the way so that, you know, he could do all this for him. And he also shared with me that he'd like for me to not contact him ever. So I had never made my amends to him. So right after all of this stuff with my mom, I get a phone call from him, and he says, you were right, I'm a terrible alcoholic. My second wife left me too because of my drinking, and I'm in AA, and my sponsor got sober with you, and he's standing here, and he made me call you. And he said, what are you doing? And I go, well, I actually had been engaged to be married, and I was supposed to be on my honeymoon right now, and we broke up 3 months before the wedding, and I'm sitting here trying to figure out what I'm going to do with myself. I go, I'm thinking about painting my house. And he goes, well, I'll be right there. So he got in his truck, and he drove to Dallas to come help me paint my house. And he and I spent 4 days together, and we painted my house, and we went to AA, and we talked. And I got to make my amends to him over a 3-day period. And I'm so grateful that almost 10 years had passed, because I was really aware, in a way, at 10 years, I could not have been aware at 1 year of how I had harmed him. It wasn't the shameful things, you know, the embarrassing things that I said or all of that. It was because I withheld my love from him, just like I did my mom. And I made him responsible for my happiness. And whenever I wasn't happy, I tortured him. And so I got to make amends for that, and it was really beautiful. And he's still sober and happy today, and we're really good friends. It was a great thing. The other good thing that happened during that was, you know, he remembers everything. And although I wasn't really a blackout drinker, I don't remember a lot of things. And one thing, he was like, remember that time we went to the Christmas party at the bank and we stole the keg? I was like, no. I was like, yeah, we stole the keg. And the owner of the bank called us the next morning, and he was like, you know, we have cameras at the bank. You and Krista need to take that keg back to the party stop in the morning if you can. If it's done, we're like, oh, it's done. So anyway, I just want to talk a little bit about sponsorship. I have been really, really blessed to have fantastic sponsorship throughout my whole sobriety. I have the unconditional love that I have gotten from my sponsor has really changed me at a cellular level. You know, it's funny, a typical conversation with my sponsor today would be, you know, I'll call her and I'll be like, you know, I've gathered all the evidence they are out to get me, and I've decided that I'm going to burn this mother down. And she'll say, I think it's a good idea, but can you wait until Friday? I'll say, yes, I can wait. So I'll call her in 30 minutes. I'm sorry, I just can't wait till Friday. I'm burning it down. And she'll say, okay, do it. And let me know how it goes. And what I love about that is that she understands that until I get to the end of my own thinking, until I understand that my way isn't going to work, I'm never going to have a spiritual experience. If I'm doing it for her, if I'm doing it because that's what I think that she should do or that's what she's told me to do, I may feel okay for that moment, but I'm just going to recreate this exact same situation and do it again until I can have a real surrender. And, you know, whenever she's been my sponsor for a long, long time, about, you know, 15, 16 years. And when I call her, she'll say, you know, one of three things. She will say, the answer is more love. She'll say, you know, which is, you know, what would God have me be? She'll say, wait. Because she understands that a lot of the success of Alcoholics Anonymous is through this process of distraction. While we're going to meetings, while we're working the steps, while we're, you know, being of service to others, God can get in there and change us. And a good night's sleep cures a lot of things. So she'll say more love, or she'll say wait, or she'll say more self-care. And that third one, more self-care, is usually the one that is required. Because I still am prone to, you know, get disconnected and start trying to reconnect to other things, you know, to the material world. And I forget that I have entered the spiritual world. And so I'm really amazed at how she understands the concepts that we talk about here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she brings them to me in this way that that really changes me. You know, sometimes I'll call her and, you know, twist it around the axle about something, and she'll say, oh, look how cute you are out there managing your own life. She'll say, you know, I'm going to my country house. Won't you grab a bag and come stay with me? Or me and Gary, we're on our way to go to a meeting. We're going to go and eat. Won't you come be with us? She'll say, whatever it is that she says, I am in the big fat middle of my life, Krista, and you are invited. Come be with me. And she has never said, well, sounds like you've made 1,000 decisions based on self. Won't you do some writing, find your part, and call me? She never has said that to me, even though that's clearly the answer in what I've done. She always comes at me from that place of love. And you know, when I came in, you guys said that I never had to be alone again, and I never had to drink again unless I wanted to. And in that way, that promise really has come true for me. I've gone to AA meetings all over the world and all over the country, and I always have a place to be and people that understand me. And what I have learned about myself is that that feels like love to me. When to be understood feels like love. And I feel a part of here. And it's just, it's beautiful and amazing. So, so I was going to a meeting in AA and at this new group. And me and my gay friend Sam went. And there was this woman there, and she was beautiful. And she had, you know, 150 years of sobriety or something. We could tell that she was the matriarch of this meeting. And we wanted to sit by her. So we're sitting there, and her share, she goes, girls, listen up. He ain't coming. Ain't no man coming to save you. And even if he does, you're going to get tired of feeding, financing, and the other F word. So you better get you God, and you better get him today. Better get you God. That'll solve all your problems. So after she shared, you know who that is, don't you? Yeah. So after her share, I looked at Sam and I was like, girl, we are not coming back here and sitting by her again. I go, second of all, he may not be coming for her, clearly, but he is coming for us. He is coming for us. So I spent the next 10 years feeding, finance, fixing, and fiddling them. And she was right. They were all terrible, terrible higher powers. And but, you know, I don't regret any of that. Each one of them taught me something about myself that I just could not have learned any other way. And, you know, each relationship, you know, a part of myself, these character defects, these instincts gone awry, you know, were revealed and healed. And so 3 years ago, I went to the Gathering of the Eagles conference, and they asked me to be in a skit. And there was, you know, about 12 people on that skit, and I'd known all of them for a long, long time, years and years, and except one. And I said, did you just move here? And he's like, no, I've lived here my whole life. And I said, well, how much sobriety do you have? 23 years. And I said, what group do you go to? He goes, Clean Air. I was like, have you ever seen me in your life? He was like, no. And I was like, that is impossible. I found out that he had just had dinner with my sponsor like 2 weeks before that. I was like, how can that be that we have just been, you know, circling around each other for all these years and never met? I mean, this is weird. And so we got engaged 8 weeks later. And, you know, when you know, you know. And that I'm so, you know, it's we got married on 12-12-12. At 12-12. We needed all the 12s we could get. When I flew into Gunnison this weekend, I landed at 12-12. I knew it was going to be a good conference. So, you know, I'm so grateful that, you know, I have come to a place that my goal is to learn how to be a partner. Instead of, you know, trying to get Steve to be some way so that I can be happy. So I don't have to make him responsible for my happiness and torture him whenever I'm not. I'm so grateful that, you know, behind my back, without my permission, when I wasn't looking, God changed those things about me. And I'm so grateful that I didn't have to be shinier or prettier or smarter or figure it out. And we have a really a beautiful life together. And, you know, AA is a huge part of our life. I mean, we are in it to win it. We're in it all the way. And we have sponsors, and we sponsor people, and we're involved, and we have a home group, and we go on vacation. And, you know, going to an AA meeting is part of our vacation. We schedule it, and we make it happen. And it's just amazing. And, you know, I'm also a stepmom. And, you know, it's so funny, you know, to have this girl in my life. I didn't think that I was going to be a mom. And I, you know, she has just grown. She's caused me to grow up parts of myself that I didn't know needed growing up. But she's also, you know, shown me this really beautiful side of myself that I didn't know existed. You know, I too get to experience the part of parenthood that when they mirror your stuff back to you, you know, the funny parts, and, you know, whenever they come to you and say, you know, at 9:30 at night, oh, I need 25 cupcakes in the morning, homemade, it's contest, you know, stuff like that. It's awesome. It really is. And, you know, I'm going to read two things. This was from a plaque that was on Dr. Bob's desk, and it's about humility. It says, perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is to never be frustrated or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me, and when I am blamed or despised. Is to have a blessed home in myself where I can go in and shut the door and pray to my Father in secret and be at peace. As in a deep sea of calmness when all around and about is seeming trouble. And I have gotten to experience that. There's a place inside of me that knows it's okay, it's always been okay, and it's always going to be okay. And I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm forever grateful for that. All you get is all you give, so give it all you got. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.